This episode of We Are Libertarians is brought to you by Audible.com. Enjoy one free audiobook courtesy of We Are Libertarians. Choose from more than 100,000 audiobook titles, including works by Ron Paul, Walter Block, Murray Rothbard, and the Cato Institute. Audible.com also has audio of radio and TV programs and audio versions of magazines and newspapers. You can get the Audible app on any mobile device or download the audio to your computer. Go to audibletrial.com/WAL or head to WeAreLibertarians.com and find the link to get one free month of Audible today. Welcome to We Are Libertarians for this week. I am Chris Spangle, and to my right, as always, is Mr. Reliable, Greg Lenz. How are you doing?
I'm doing well, Chris. How are you?
Doing great. To his right is, actually, I think it's your first time on We Are Libertarians, Chris?
It is.
And Chris Peffers, brother of Dan Peffers, previously on this podcast.
The man, the legend.
Yep. So you are well-bearded, sir, just like your brother.
Thank you.
The skinny Zach Galifianakis.
I would say.
Yeah, you do look a little bit like Zach Galifianakis.
Yeah, I get that about twice a week.
Right.
From strangers, so.
You for a brief moment in time, you hosted a podcast for one episode with the dearly departed Chris Gault.
Yeah.
Never to air. So, but
is
it was
it
a good
still
show.
On the internet?
Yeah, it is.
Yeah, so if you want to listen to me and Chris Gault talk about nothing for like an hour,
yeah.
Check that out. Nearly Total Nonsense.
NearlyTotalNonsense.com. It's still up there, so.
Awesome.
Have you talked to our buddy? Have you talked to him?
I'll probably see him again once Game of Thrones starts up. That seems to be the pattern whenever we find a TV show.
You guys get together with your girlfriends and watch
the
show?
Nah. Yeah, clearly that's what we're doing.
Is he doing okay? I know.
As far as I know, he shaved his goatee.
What?
He's working. Yeah.
I know he got a haircut. He doesn't look like a damn hippie anymore.
Yeah. What a shame.
I know. So, well, I know many in the audience miss Chris Gault. I occasionally miss Chris Gault, especially when we need somebody to argue with Creighton. He was so skilled at that. So tell him we all said hi. Now, tell us a little bit about yourself. Like, what kind of libertarian would you classify yourself as?
I guess you could call me, I'm like a conservative hippie.
Okay.
Like, I'm really more like a philosophical libertarian, I guess. I like to daydream and like...
Right. Right.
Yeah.
You don't like to actually do anything. You just like to...
Yeah, kind of.
Well, welcome to the podcast. You're
perfect.
I need
people like you to hang around and...
Philosophize.
Yeah. Well, yeah, and we need people like Maya to push us to do stuff.
Right. All right. Speaking of which, the pink elephant in the room. the last time that our...
Episode 50.
Our intrepid hero, Maya Axton, was on the podcast. She, as she does every podcast, did not stay for the end and walked out. And then we had a fight. And then that's when she publicly declared, I will never, ever, ever go back on that show again. So I think I speak for everyone when I say, what the f*** are you doing here?
Well, because you guys have kind of had a loss amongst the input from some of your other members, I felt the need to reimpose myself onto the podcast and bring some more an intellectual fortitude to the podcast, since some people have turned from anarcho-capitalist to libertarian to I love John McCain. I'm not going to name names. And some other people have kind of just dropped off the face of Earth, mentally wise, and is busy with other stuff. So I decided I needed to come in here and reimpose myself onto the podcast for your guys' benefit and for all of you fans out there. I know there was quite a few of you that wrote in and missed me very, very much. You didn't come over
Maya.
To the Uncontrollables, my show, but thanks anyways, assholes.
I think they're listening to the show report, right?
Right. They're big fans of the show report.
If you're a fan of mine and you listen to the show report, I will hunt you down and chop off all your digits with a dull, rusty hatchet. I promise you.
I think you just weren't getting enough attention on your own podcast.
Actually, no. I had like 100 unique listeners on my live podcast the other day.
Which is, tell people where they can get the two engaging Maya Axton podcasts.
Well, I'm going to start doing all my shows live, and it's new time, Tuesday, at 3 p.m. to 4 p.m. on indianatalks.com. The number is usually posted all over the place. I think it's 260-355-5151. And
no phone screener.
Yeah, no phone screener.
I just like to throw that out there.
Oh, my.
That is good to know.
Right on air. Now, I get to see your number. I see your number. And if I can see your number, that means I can find out where you live.
Payphones still work in this city.
That's right.
This isn't one of those cities where the payphones don't work anymore.
I still crank call. I crank called like several times the first episode because what's she going to do? She can murder me, but then she has to buy her own equipment, so...
No, it's already written in your will that I get all your equipment when you die. I know your lawyer.
Would you create a will for me? I'm not that adult.
Yeah.
So, welcome back, Maya. You can find all of Maya's podcasts at wal-radio.com or go to creatingmaya.com or theuncontrollables.com. If you go to wal-radio.com, we added a few more podcasts there today, and we're... You know, in the midst of our show prep, we always find a lot of interesting videos, so we're going to throw up a raw audio feed of some of the audio from interviews and speeches and things that we think are interesting that you might want to listen to, so you can be a more informed voter. So get those two feeds, and then also Daryl Perry does a podcast, Peace, Love, Liberty, and he has several different shows and does it live as well on LRN.FM, which if you don't know what that is, go to LRN.FM and look it up. And you can grab his feed there, and then we're cross-promoting a little bit. So Daryl runs a book publishing company, and you can find out all the information about him at wal-radio.com. So that is the end of the shilling for this week.
The shilling should never end.
The shilling should never end. You're right. Go to audibletrial.com/WAL and get a free audiobook courtesy of us. So we have something really exciting. Ron Paul, the man, the myth, the legend, is coming to Indiana here on Tuesday, September the 10th. And in an effort to promote his visit at DePaul University at the Performing Arts Center there, he's actually agreed to do an interview with this program. And I can't believe it either. So we actually are doing this interview for both the Show Report, one of our other podcasts, and We Are Libertarians. So Ryan Ripley, Joe Ruiz, and I had the pleasure of sitting down earlier today, Friday of this past week, with Dr. Ron Paul to talk about Syria, to talk about millennials and politics, and to talk about his upcoming visit. So check it out. Here is We're Libertarians and the Show Report interviewing Dr. Ron Paul.
Today we have the honor of welcoming three-time presidential candidate, former congressman, and author of the books that introduced Chris, Joe, and I to libertarian principles, Dr. Ron Paul. Dr. Paul, thank you for joining us.
Great to be with you. Looking forward to our visit.
So first we must ask about Syria. If we were to intervene in Syria, in your opinion, what are the dominoes that will be tipped over by that action?
Well, nobody can be certain, but the only thing you can be certain of is that there will be some unexpected events occurred. It's always going to cost more and more people die than they expect. But, you know, even if that doesn't happen, let's say it comes off across, from Obama's viewpoint, relatively successful, I still think it's horrible, you know, because it's wrong to do it. It's not the way the law is written. It's not the way the Constitution is written. And if something halfway successful came of it, it would only encourage them. I don't think we have to worry about that. What we have to worry about are things going badly, which means the war could spread. You know, the Russians have a lot at stake over there, and they're moving vessels in there. Now, I don't think anybody, you know, is going to, on our side, deliberately fire on a Russian vessel. That'd be crazy. But somebody who would like to stir the pot would, and that could really lead to a lot of trouble. But it's bound to spread. The war will continue. It's been going on. This is part of the war to remake the Middle East. That's been going on now for 14 years. It's going to continue. So no matter what happens, what the consequences are, no matter what the Congress does, that will continue. But unfortunately, I think we should be very, very concerned and expect the worst.
As you look through the media over the last couple of weeks, as Syria has been debated, do you think the media and the American people have learned the lessons from the lead-up to Iraq and some of the propaganda that we experienced in the lead-up to Iraq? Do you see a difference now versus 10 years ago?
I think so, and I hope I'm not fooling myself, because always in the past it seems logically that the people wouldn't support it. But this has been going back all the way to World War One and Two. People didn't want it. The president's got elected by saying, I'll keep you out of war, keep you out of war. And then they always turn around and get the people into war. And the statistics were very much opposed, going into both Persian Gulf War and the Iraq War, and the war propagandists were able to turn it around. But I still think there's reason to be hopeful that the people are more alert now than ever before. But they are very, very powerful. They talk with strong assurances. They speak, like they have all the information, and they speak the truth. But governments have lost a lot of credibility with the economy and on foreign policy. And right now the messages are overwhelmingly in support of not going in and getting further involved in Syria. So it remains to be seen, but if we go by history, the war propagandists will win. And maybe it'll be a narrow victory. But the recent vote with the Justin Amash Amendment on the NSA legislation, excuse me, was very encouraging, because it was a coalition of non-leadership. It was sort of a grassroots effort by the junior members of the Democrats and the Republicans who came together, and the people supported, that amendment to restrain the NSA. So that coalition is what I'm looking forward to. Maybe we're further along than we've ever been before, which in many ways satisfies, both the progressives and the libertarians coming together on the issues that we agree on. So I think this is a crucial vote. And right now I'm keeping my fingers crossed. I predicted that they probably would get the authority with a narrow vote, and boy, do I hope I'm wrong on that. I hope they lose by a long shot is what I'm hoping for.
And Dr. Paul, your son Rand is rumored to be a contender for 2016. And lately we've seen more and more hostility towards you personally in the media. I know we saw some on MSNBC recently. How do you feel personally? How do you deal with misrepresentations of your beliefs and your character during these interviews? And what do you think the intention is behind that?
Well, it's hard for me, because I know what they're doing. I'm not important in the sense that I don't have a vote. I don't go to Washington and that sort of thing. But I think it's the indirect way of Rand, I think, is good. I think he's very fluent. He knows how to present the message. And they fear him, and they don't want that message out. So he has a tough job, because though he gets some benefits from what I have done, he also gets all the disadvantages if I have a position that the mainstream media can attack, they will, and they will distort, and they will do all these things. And I think it's a combination. They don't want our message out, and they don't want him to get further along. So I feel more badly about how it might hurt him than me getting hit again, because I've been living with that for a long time, and I sort of expect it. But the only thing that can compensate for that is just get more people waking up. And, that little episode with MSNBC, I didn't like what happened. But afterwards, I thought, and a lot of people close to me said, no, this is beneficial. A lot of people, were very willing to defend me and said it came out, quite well. Mm-hmm. But nevertheless, they're going to keep doing this. But I think there's a sentiment shifting. I think it's different than, say, the first time that happened to me in the campaign, when Giuliani attacked me for being un-American, for suggesting we had a deeply flawed foreign policy, that I was unpatriotic and all that stuff. I think conditions have changed. I keep thinking, if we win this vote, in many ways, it'll be vindication of the libertarian position of non-interventionism, and that's what I sure hope we can say after that vote next week.
So, Dr. Paul, millennials especially are very receptive to the message that many in the mainstream media, as you mentioned, fear, and they're also interested in politics. Aside from contacting the representatives, what should they, and for that matter, the rest of us, be doing to move the cause of liberty forward?
Well, it's going to depend on the individual. The most important thing is that each and every one of us, study the issues and understand them and know how to defend them, become knowledgeable about how the free market works and why monetary policy is important and why it's patriotic to stop these wars and that you're not un-American to, resist the government when they tell us that we have to do certain things. And understanding these issues and defending them as an individual, what you do after that is sort of up to the individual. And I was always told, and I believe, that if you have information and you're well versed in things, people will come and ask you. And if they ask you sincerely about your opinion and you can give good answers, this is the way you change people's minds. I did that for a lot of years, and I usually went to college campuses and I'd get 5, 10, 20 people out to some small group and try to convert people over to the cause of liberty. Today, the audiences are bigger. There's more enthusiasm, and I think the whole generation of young people now are waking up, and they know the economy doesn't work. They don't like the violence of the wars. They like the whole idea of civil liberties. So I think conditions are so much better. But everybody can figure out what to do. There's no one thing. Not everybody should run for office, and not everybody should support candidates. But you can be teachers and writers and do work on the internet. You can spread a message. But I think the most important thing is to be knowledgeable and have the right tone with people, because you read a lot of harsh language on the internet, and a lot of people on both sides, just sort of shouting at each other. That doesn't work. I think the only time it's important is if somebody respects your viewpoints and they come and ask you, then you're making progress.
Now, Dr. Paul, you've been very active since your retirement. You have the Ron Paul Institute for Peace and Prosperity. You've got your homeschool curriculum, the television channel, the Ron Paul Channel. What do you see as your goals and possibly your legacy in your post-congressional career?
Well, I don't think in terms of legacy. I hope I have some influence in moving the direction of the country toward, confidence in the ideas of liberty and self-reliance. And that, I think, is happening not because of me, but because of many others as well. I mean, people do talk about Austrian economics now and free markets. So I think that's the most important thing. But I think of myself more as trying to get people interested enough to read and study and become educated rather than being political. Even though I was in politics all that time, I took a different course in staying put, obeying the rules, follow the leadership, bide your time, become a chairman of a committee, something like that, which I had no interest in. And my idea was to speak to people outside of Washington to try to get them interested. And I think that's happening, but there's a lot. It's so different now than when I was in college in the 50s. It was hard. If you question what was going on, it was hard to find any answers. You didn't have an internet. You had 3 TV stations. The professors all taught the same thing. And it took me a long time to find, the literature and the economists that I agreed with. Today, there are many, many teaching in the universities, and the internet is just a wonderful opportunity, and that's why I'm making use of it, both in the homeschooling curriculum, also in the Ron Paul Channel, which is internet-related. And I think the tools are available now, and this is why I think we've made the progress. Not only because of our communication skills, but also the blatant failure of what they've been trying for 100 years. And I see the modern world, matter of fact, the whole world in terms of human history is very, very short compared to the billions of years that the universe has existed. So it's very, very short, and most of it's been introduction to the principles of liberty, but most of it's been war and killing. And I think that we could usher in a new age where people all of a sudden can use technology, steer people away from the violence. And the big contest going on there now is the government going to succeed in taking over the internet and taking away all our privacy and all our freedom of speech. So it's up for grabs right now, but right now we're enjoying a lot of benefits from the communications revolution. Mm-hmm.
So, Dr. Paul, as you mentioned, it's important to be knowledgeable about the issues. It's important to be able to articulate them correctly. And one particular area, you know, that I believe you cover in your manifesto, and one that that is very shocking to people, is the elimination of income tax. And that's one that that many of us run into resistance on. I was wondering if you could give us the quick, you know, pros and cons of such an approach. What would it take to truly remove this income tax that seems to be so ingrained in people, and how such an idea, not only, I mean, we all believe it is good, but how could that move forward and really make some serious positive change within our federal government?
Well, you have to remember that it's not a technical adjustment. You know, how do we raise money and keep doing the things that we're doing and get rid of the income tax and maybe have a flat tax or a sales tax or something like that? Now, the tax problem, especially the income tax, is a reflection of what the people accept the role of government ought to be. So if your generation continues to believe that the role of government is to police the world, manage the economy, and tell people how to be safe so that they don't hurt themselves and tell you every little thing you can do in a nanny state. No, you have to have a huge government. It's going to grow. The liberties are going to be defeated. The wars are going to continue, and you can't get rid of the income tax. But the best example is we haven't had an income tax until this whole mess started. 100 years, we got the Federal Reserve, we got the income tax, we had a change in our foreign policy, we ushered in the welfare state. But that's all coming to an end. Keynesianism is essentially dead. So if they look back, they ought to study the economics from the period of time of the 1870s up until World War One. It was the greatest growth period we ever had. It was the period of time when we had the best example of using the gold standard, and the economic growth was probably the best in the world ever, especially for us in this country. But it's been totally rejected. So, we, even with the imperfections of the 18th and 19th century, we didn't have an income tax, you know, until the 20th century. So, but if you want big government, you're going to have an income tax and a lot more, and that's what has to be rejected. They have to decide what the role of government ought to be.
Mm-hmm. Well, Dr. Paul, we truly appreciate you spending your time with us this afternoon and the insights that you've provided to us. It truly is an honor to talk to you, sir. We're looking forward to seeing you September 10th at DePaul University here in Indiana. That should be a great event as well. Is there anything you'd like to add to this? Anything that you'd like to quickly note before we wrap up?
Nothing special other than the fact that I do enjoy coming to the universities and I do enjoy meeting young people, because a lot of them give me encouragement by just listening to them and knowing that they're interested. So I get a lot of credit, but the young people should get a lot of credit, because without their enthusiasm, who knows, I could become discouraged. I wouldn't want to do that.
No, not at all, sir. We truly do appreciate your time, and we cannot thank you enough for joining us, Dr. Paul.
Good to be with you.
All right. Well, that was an interview that we had with Dr. Ron Paul in advance of his event. He's coming to DePaul University in Greencastle, Indiana on September 10th. I will be there. Greg Lenz will be there. We're going to hopefully get another interview, and we'll recap the event at WeAreLibertarians.com. So it was really interesting to hear what he had to say. So let's get on to topics now. All right, so let's get into it. Syria is...
Syria.
Yeah,
that's
Syria.
That country in South America, right?
Right. Syria is...
I think it's a state.
Where they make all the breakfast flakes... I don't know.
A lot of killers come from there.
When we last left you, I had pre-recorded. I was editing the show as the president started speaking, and he made a not so stunning announcement that he was going to
follow the Constitution he swore to uphold.
No, that was the
that
surprising
would be a
part.
Stunning yeah. announcement.
That
right.
was a stunning announcement.
The first part, he said he was going to bomb Syria, which everybody already knew. And then the second part, he was going to go to Congress, and he was going to get authorization for the action in Congress, which shocked the hell out of me. So I made a few comments about it, and what was your guys' take? I mean, my take on it was good, first of all. I thought it was good for him, because at the time, it gave him an out. Because it was clear when we talked last that he didn't want to really bomb Siri. He didn't want to really get involved. He had painted himself into a corner. And this was sort of an out for him because, hey, he can blame the Republicans in Congress if this doesn't go through. And that's sort of his MO. But it is a politically risky move. And at this point, it looks like it's probably not going to pass the House, probably won't pass the Senate. They changed the language today to make it a little more aggressive to get John McCain on board, and as a result, they lost the left. So it's probably not going to happen if you're watching the Washington Post's count of votes.
It'll happen. It just won't have congressional approval.
Well, we'll talk about that here in a second, so don't let me forget that, because that's an interesting question. What was your first reaction when you heard that Barack Obama was going, when he had magically discovered the Constitution, Greg?
I actually thought it was the most presidential I'd seen him since 2008 when he was campaigning. I get it. You know, it's politically popular, and it's not often the politically popular thing to do is also the constitutional and right thing to do. But I'm not going to bash him because he is following the Constitution to the letter of the law. I supported what he said, and I won't knock him for it.
What was your thought, Peffers?
So what exactly did he do? Sorry.
Oh,
not
Peffers.
As well-informed as I
Man,
should be.
He came out and was
time watching the Daily
he
Show.
He was like 45 minutes late to his own speech, and he made his little speech, and he left without answering any questions. Now,
that
let me
seems
go ahead.
Pretty run-of-the-mill.
Hey, yeah. Greg, he didn't say he was going to uphold the Constitution. You're completely wrong about that. I'm reading the text of the speech yet again, and he said he decided we should attack Syria. Mm-hmm. Then he decided that it's in the best interest of our constitutional democracy and our democracy that he should maybe go talk to Congress about it. He never said, this is because the law forces me to, this is the law of our country. No, the way he made it seem is that he's like, I'm also mindful that I'm the president of the world's oldest constitutional democracy. And so he talks a little bit and he makes all this stuff. And that's why I've made a second decision. I will seek authorization for the use of force from the American people's representatives in Congress. Nowhere other than when he says constitutional democracy that he's mentioned the Constitution or the law or anything else. He says he made the decision for the people's sake to go to Congress.
Now, the reason it was surprising is because of the War Powers Act. Because the president, from Harry Truman on, has not gone and sought authorization for military action in Korea, Vietnam, Iraq, Cambodia. None of it was approved.
It doesn't seem like Congress is really going to weigh into his decision. Like, he's kind of just doing it because it seems like a phony move. Like, he's literally only doing it because he thinks he'll get votes
right
for it.
Now, the justification for all this is the War Powers Act, passed in the 70s. Tell us a little bit about the War Powers Act and why the president essentially thinks he is no longer bound by what the letter of the Constitution says.
Well, he actually isn't legally, because the War Powers Act gives him 60 days to strike a foreign country and then 30 days to begin pulling them out after those 60. So he has a full 60 days to authorize a strike on a foreign country as long as he begins pulling troops back after those 60 days and gets everyone back in the full 90.
As long as he deems it in the national interest,
And here's where it gets really interesting. If the Congress agrees to fund such a strike, it can be interpreted that they have deemed it passed, that they have gone ahead and authorized it.
Which is how they finagled Iraq. Now, that has always been the argument on behalf of increasing the presidency's power, is that ultimately, Congress still holds the purse strings and that they're hamstrung. But that's a false argument because we saw this in Iraq. What are they going to do? Not vote for bullets? You know, even the most staunch liberals who were anti-war, like Dennis Kucinich, still were voting for vests and bullets and, they were funding the war.
I support our troops, but not the war.
Right. But they're still voting to fund the war. So there were people
can't let them die.
Right. So the War Powers Act has been the standard operating procedure. So it was interesting to see Barack Obama, do you think that it diminished the power of the presidency, Maya Axton?
No, I think what he did was a political maneuver. I think with the meetings he had leading up to that speech, with the meetings that have been going on, and his administration being very boots on the ground, knowing what the social sphere is saying and what's going on in the country, he made a decision in the best interest of the Democratic Party and his allies in Congress and in the Senate and in, throughout the government that we should bring this up to a vote to appease the American people, not to actually have a real discussion. Because as he says, I have made a decision to attack Syria. I have made a decision to do this. I was told this was not a good idea to go to Congress. Blah, 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 blah. He said himself, and he's talking right. like
and,
a dictator.
And
but
John Kerry has consistently said, as John Kerry has been the face for all of this, he felt that he could have acted without Congress's permission. He just felt that it was right, and he could still act even if you vote against it.
Yeah, and that's basically what the president said in his speech. You read that speech for what it is. It's a scary, scary thing. He's basically just pandering to all the people getting uppity about the war. It's not going to change anything. All the protests, all the calling the congressmen, that's not going to change the end result. It'll change how they handle it and how much we know about it. It sure will, because they're worried about re-elections and everything else. And so I don't see this as anything but a giant another political maneuver. This is just he's setting the Democratic Party up for a better end result through this, as he was a Democratic president that brought this to Congress and blah, 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 blah.
And the former constitutional law professor.
Yeah, and which he calls us a constitutional democracy, which has never existed before, but
right.
that's okay. And but he was basically helping out the Democrats for 2014. That's what I see. This is one giant political maneuver, if you look at it for what it really is.
Well, I don't know if he had another choice. I mean, he and every single person in his cabinet 10 years earlier were saying the opposite of what they're saying now. I mean, how do you basically betray everything that you said in the lead up to the Iraq war?
But he has anyways on everything else he's ever said, and every
sure.
all candidates do it. Look at John
yeah.
McCain. Look at all the politicians we see up in front of us right now. All of them.
Just seems like something presidents do
right.
to me.
And all politicians, they constantly look at Dick Lugar. Do you think his entire career, do you think at the beginning of his career to the very end of his very 200-year-long campaign, do you think his stance was the same throughout? No. He flip-flopped. Look at John Gregg in our last gubernatorial election. He helped author the DOMA bill. But then he's all saying, I support gay people. I support
right.
same – well, he kind of said, I support same-sex marriage. Actually, he said it. But look, they flip-flop constantly. So to think that's a surprise thing or that they care that people know they're flip-flopping, no, they don't, because people don't remember what happened last year, let alone 10 years ago.
Right. So it is a huge risk for Barack Obama. If, you know, he saw the reaction to Cameron's defeat in the U.K., and then the next day he makes the same decision. That evening he decides to basically go the same route as Cameron. And it's called a humiliation. It's called a giant defeat, which I don't think it's humiliating. It's only humiliating because Wolf Blitzer repeatedly uses that word. And so people think it's humiliating. So it's a political – it's a rhetoric thing. But effectively – he's spending all of his political capital on this, which is...
But does he have any? I would argue he has none.
Right.
If he can make this positive, he has some. If he doesn't do anything, he still has none. The only thing's upside for him.
So here's the funny thing. I mean, in my mind, as president, you've still got a little bit of juice going into your second term. You've got the debt limit fight that you've got to win, coming up. You've got immigration still on the table. You've got what are some of the other things that the NSA stuff has greatly eroded his legacy. This is a big session coming up in the next 40 days starting on September 9th, and then you put this in the middle of it, you're totally washing out all of those big items, and I don't know if that works to his favor or not.
It does. He's paying people back right now. Remember, we just had a bunch of DOD cuts. There's been cuts everywhere, right? Well, remember, they're going to have to get special funding for this.
Right.
Then we're going to have to excuses that, hey, we're fighting Russia, who's more advanced than we are, and they shot down a couple of our planes. We need to build new planes. That means Lockheed Martin and Boeing and all them need more money,
Raytheon.
Which they've been cutting down. This is lobbyists and corporatism and the corporatism in America, this false capitalism that we have, working at its finest. The big military, the military-industrial complex is losing money.
Yeah, of the votes, An interesting fact on that, of the votes that are a firm yes as, at this moment, 83% of them, their biggest donors are defense contractors.
Mm-hmm. And that's what this is that the defense contractors are losing money. Iraq and Afghanistan slowing down. Everything else is starting to slow down. We need to revitalize it. We've had too many projects scrapped, too many, like the F-35 basically being scrapped. That was a lot of money to a lot of jobs. We got to do something about that. So if we take our equipment we have now and our kind of our, some of our rundown stuff that we have left over from Iraq and everything else that we're not selling to local police forces like Greenfield, then we're going to have to build new stuff because the Russians are more advanced. Well, that's a threat to our national security of having a behind-the-times military. So we'll have to spend even more money. But you know what that'll do? That'll revitalize the economy. Remember, bombs are a good thing for the economy because they produce value, don't they not? I mean, the broken window fallacy says so. So that's what I see this is the lobbyists, the prior commitments, the military-industrial complex needs their new war.
But,
and this is it.
But there's the phone calls coming in are 100-1 against it. You have many of the senators are going into these briefings to the point that Dianne Feinstein today said that she's amping up her efforts, and she is having the CIA print out gory pictures of dead bodies that have been gassed to show the senators because the intelligence that they're presenting is not working, so now she's using an emotional appeal. She's one of the few leadership, though, that are actually advocating for this. The leadership of the House is for it, Boehner and Pelosi, but they're not whipping for it. They've expressly said this is a vote of conscience. We're not going to whip for it. Harry Reid is for it, but he is not whipping for it. And McConnell has made no statement as to his intentions at
he
this
can't.
Point.
He's and, battled down in a,
right.
a primary fight right
now. And so the unpopular position is no on war, as opposed to 10 years ago when the popular position was yes on war. And it just seems to me that if Barack Obama loses this vote, which I hope he does, he's done. He's a lame duck president for the next 3 years.
False. That's completely – that. There's no way. With everything Obama's gotten done to the detriment, look at what his health care bill – if this vote would make him a lame duck president, why didn't his health care bill do that? Knowing that, seeing already the effects of it, when UPS cuts out how many tens of thousands of people from benefits and all these other countries, and you have all the other crap Obama's gotten away with. Not to mention,
yeah, but
you look at Bush, look at Clinton, look at everything those guys got away with. That was before the internet really started picking up back under Clinton. But now we know everything that he did, and people still knew about it, and it didn't destroy his presidency. Obama. Now you talk about how many people are calling in, right?
Mm-hmm.
How many people calling in? How many people calling? Blah, 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 blah. Well, I'm sorry. Still 60% of this country isn't engaged in politics. The 60% of the people that actually vote aren't engaged in politics, don't care, and they don't vote for political reasons.
See, that's bullcrap. I mean, if you look at the study that came out about the NSA vote, 70% of Americans that were polled said that they were watching and seeing what was going on with the NSA.
But you know
people
what happens?
People were engaged with it.
You know what happens? Is we bring up attention like this, you know what's going to happen with Syria if this vote goes bad and Obama decides not to do it on his own? We'll do it anyways. We've used Israel and other countries and other things as proxies for our wars. We've used Israel hundreds of times to destroy people. We'll use sanctions. We'll do something. We will, without a doubt, attack Syria.
All right. So let's go over here for a minute because I want to ask, do you think that if, you know, he's not fighting for this vote, by the way, he's flying over to the G20 summit he can make phone calls from Air Force One. It's a long ride from America to Stockholm. He made 5 phone calls to 5 representatives. So he made a total of 5 phone calls to representatives to stump for his case. He's not fighting for it. What does that say? I mean, if this vote goes down and he loses, what does that mean?
I don't think it means, like, a ton. Obama's probably, like, one of the scrappiest politicians I've ever seen. That dude can come back from just about any political fault with, like, a smile and a wink. I think he's done after presidency. Like, I think he's never going to be a politician again.
Right.
He's aged horribly. But I think he'll still get stuff to happen. Just, it'll slow down. You know?
Any thoughts, Greg?
Yeah, I would tend to disagree with that. I'd actually think he's one of the least scrappy politicians I've ever. That's just my opinion. I feel like he has an entitlement that he has always been the smartest, that he is somehow above the fray and doesn't expect to get dirty and bogged down. It's his opinion is the enlightened opinion. If you're against it, you're a moron. Why am I even bothering with you right now?
He totally has that little brain syndrome.
Yeah,
like,
I don't see what that has to do with his scrappiness. I feel like after all he's done, his people still stand by Obama. He's still got this fan base that would vote for him over, you know.
He's got a 44% approval rating.
Like, yeah, but if it put it to a vote, like for a presidency, I think he would beat pretty much any
if he
other
ran for president
real contender.
Again. So hypothetically, if he ran for president again, he'd win again.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, any Democrat would.
No, I don't think any Democrat
would. Bill Clinton was doing what he was doing in the White House. I mean, he left with what, like a 60% approval rating?
There won't be a Republican candidate winning until there's a seismic shift in the Republican principles.
Right.
It's actually impossible mathematically.
I think you're going about this with a little too much positivity in a little too much pep in your step there, Chris, is that you're thinking that politics happen realistically in Congress and the Senate, that these people actually care at all about what the voting populace thinks. No, they only care what their advisors tell them that may or may not hurt their election or hurt the people that they're fighting for.
I would have to disagree with that, because
you don't think that 100-to-1 calling in is going to hurt your reelection efforts?
Well, we were just talking about how like all these ancient senators are constantly flip-flopping, and that's because they fear not being reelected.
No, that's what I'm saying, is that they don't really care. They change how they deliver their messages.
They
change
waves.
Things around. But they don't ever stop being who they are.
I feel like this whole distaste for this Syria war, I feel like there's a lot more politicians speaking out against this war than there was the last war and all the wars.
But you
got to
think about this too.
Having.
Syria, right? Syria's not that big of a deal when you consider every single other thing we're involved in right now. All the other combat operations, all the CIA operations, everything else we're involved in and doing. We've been constantly touch and go with Russia for a decade now with their missile defense systems and everything else we're doing over there. The fact that we're constantly funding Israel and doing things with Israel and continuing to increase our sanctions on all the other countries over there just goes to show that we're constantly stirring stuff up over there. Constantly. We have control over everything over there.
Why don't you get into that? Because this is not Maya's show. Maya is just guesting. And Maya came in with roughly 12 hours of research and prep work for the show. And made Greg and I look like morons. So, no offense, Greg, but I mean,
that
I was
my first impression of you, Greg.
I was a little
pissed.
I come
pissed. In here, I meet you, and then Maya makes you look like a moron.
That happens more often, I think.
All right, Maya, I can appreciate that.
Hey, don't worry. Maya tries to frame the issue. Everyone but her is a moron,
and that usually plays out to be true.
All right, so why don't you tell us a little bit about the history of America and Syria and some of our actions? You know, I say when I look at it, the argument that the United States or the president is going to lose credibility really is one of the most ridiculous things I've ever heard. Like, it's not about our credibility. You shouldn't bomb another country because of credibility. Like, what is best for the people of Syria? And what is best for the people of Syria is, at this point, Obama has screwed them either way. I mean, if you saw what I posted on WeAreLibertarians.com the other day about the Anderson Cooper clip, there was the activist from Syria who said, Obama has done a horrible thing to us. I don't know if we can survive. Because if you don't bomb, then he'll just gas us more. He'll just do it more because he thinks he can. But if you do bomb, then that could set off World War III. You know, we're being bombed, and they're just going to ramp up their efforts. So American intervention into this situation has really made this worse, but it's not an isolated incident.
I think we need to just stop building all these countries in the desert. Like, that just...
Yeah.
Those people, I don't know.
Yeah.
Those people.
Damn,
people.
I don't want to...
It's like idiots building, you know, cities down in New Orleans when hurricanes hit every other year.
Or
they
maybe
have to
like
live on
in
levees,
Indianapolis.
But, right. No, but
a solid place to build a city. There's food here. There's not sand everywhere.
I'm just guessing that if we start shipping in Syrians by the millions,
I'm not saying
the people of Indianapolis are going to love that.
Yeah, I'm not
They're
saying...
So
think the Free State Project's bad. Wait till you see Syrians in Indianapolis.
They're so tolerant here. Watch Porter Ridge.
You racist mother.
So, all right. So tell us a little bit about the history of Syrian intervention and the United States, and what is some of the mixed... I mean, how did we get to this point, Maya?
Well, I had a bad case to the wikis last night, and
I had that today too.
And it's where you're like, hey, I'm going to go read the Senate Foreign Relations Committee's resolution. Hey, what's that bill they reference? Hey, what's that? And you know, 12 hours later of no sleep, and me, I'm like, I'm literally, my hands are shaking at the computer because I'm so amped. I'm like, information. It was incredible.
Infogasm.
This isn't InfoWars, this is InfoPorn.
Oh, I wikied all over Wikipedia.
So I started looking at all the things, and I've read before about the history of U.S. involvement in the Middle East before, but I've never really, really gone into the specifics like I have last night. And it was downright frightening. And the fact that, no, I've never heard any information before. I've never heard anyone talk about it. I never hear the war protesters bring it up. Places like anti-war do a really good job with a lot of their historical stuff, but none of the politicians bring this up. Rand Paul and all his infinite, you know, godlike wisdom never brings all this up, never, you know, points any fingers to it.
For you Sheldon Coopers playing at home, that was sarcasm.
Oh.
Sarcasm. So I started with the whole some bill with a really long name that they reference in the committee's report. And it talks about the Syrian Accountability and Lebanese Sovereignty Restoration Act of 2003. And I'm like, what? I don't even know what Lebanese and Syria. I don't even know what Lebanon is. And so I start going, and there's civil wars they're talking about. And also, I go back to the start of Syria, really. And in, what is it, 1946, Syria gets their independence. So not too long ago, 1946.
Independence,
yeah. They're no longer part of the Ottoman Empire, you know, all that stuff going. When you say Ottoman Empire, it just sounds like you're talking about like the 1200.
I know, right. That was such a recent thing.
Yeah, no, it just ended not like, that long ago.
I can't believe there was like a country 100 years ago that called itself that.
World War One killed it. I can talk about the – that's what I was stuck in a case of the wikis today on the Ottoman Empire for
– Yeah,
I
read your article. Is it not? Yeah. And then to see what the aftermath was. But continue on with Syria before we get off on a history masturbatory rant, but – in between, you know, 1946 Syrian independence, we recognize their independence and that their country. We send an ambassador over there to Damascus or whatever the hell that place is called. And in between 1946 and 1945, the U.S. was involved in their political process. Just little bumps and nudges here and there, I'm sure. Until 1949, the U.S. encouraged a military coup. So 3 years after this country gains their independence, we're already pushing for a military coup.
Of the current leader's dad.
Yes.
Right. Yeah.
And then, like, okay, so in between 1949 and 1954, we constantly, the U.S., constantly keeps pushing for military coups. All of them fail. But we keep pushing for them. Coup after coup after coup, we keep pushing for them. And so
we're a persistent
bunch. They're constantly now fighting. They just gained their independence, but because of the U.S., strictly because of the U.S., there's more fighting, deaths, and, you know, war-torn country that's trying to have peace. So about 1954, they get some order restored. But now Syria is war-torn, and they're scared to death of the U.S. for good reason. And so they turn to Russia for help and aid. And you know how that always turns out. Russia's like, here, have this box of food, but this box of uranium needs to be stored, you know, in one of your warehouses or something, you know, that they always do. So years later, 1957, you know, they've had 3 years of peace. That's a little too long, don't you think? What's try to do another military coup? Okay. Yeah, the U.S. tries another one. Oh, but it got found out and failed. Huh. That's weird. I don't know the exact number of military coups we supported, and the information's kind of still iffy, and half the documents are redacted to be black sheets.
Between the Middle East, Africa, Asia, and South America, and God willing, Canada, I mean, the CIA is just full of coups.
You're hoping for a Canadian coup one of these days?
The bastards need to be watched.
Yeah.
And so we keep going.
That's the border to watch, you say.
The U.S. has backed Israel for its entire existence with military and training and funding and weapons and blah, 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 blah.
And creating.
Well, around that same time, Israel was like kind of on a warpath. They're like, hey, we're just going to attack everybody. And they did. And so that kind of just, you know, Israel attacked Syria, around that same time period. And they're like, wait, Israel's basically a proxy military for the U.S. and has been since its existence, by the way. If you ever want to read up on every military action series ever taken and who's backed it and who's helped them through the UN, oh, it was the U.S. So that's cool. But so we get into what a real involvement with Syria has been. And it's mainly been because of Lebanon and their massive civil war. Like, we go to 1976, and this is just retarded. The Lebanon Civil War, which is partially funded by Syria and then also partially funded by Israel, it starts. And so it's like Israel's funding a lot of different militias and different groups. And then Iran's involved a little bit later. And then Syria's funding one group and everything else. And you're going to catch some similarities between Syria and the U.S. here soon. That Syria, if you basically start calling Syria the U.S. when it comes to Lebanon, you wouldn't be able to tell the difference by their actions. And so, hey, this gets funny. June 3rd.
Sounds hilarious.
June 3rd, 1982. Okay.
Funny date.
But Maya is the funniest person I know.
Now, hold on. Syria is going to get involved in Lebanon for national security reasons.
Right, okay.
For national security reasons, okay? Now, there's this one group called the Palestine Liberation Organization, the PLO.
Right.
I'm sure most people have heard of them
in some
way.
Yasser Arafat and all that good stuff.
That's there's a very, very long history with them. There's different splits, and there's 8 million. When we're talking about civil wars and stuff over there, we're not talking about this group versus that group. And that's how the media tries to portray it. When I'm reading about Lebanon, there's literally like 30 different militia groups. I can't keep them all straight. There's so many. There's Christians. There's this kind of Muslim. There's a grouping of Muslims and Christians. Then there's this group, secular groups, everything else. And so it goes. But the right. PLO was one of the big players. And so on June 3rd, 1982, some members of the PLO attempt to assassinate an Israeli ambassador. So what does Israel do? Bombs the out of them. They're in Lebanon. So they bomb the out of Lebanon, basically, the PLO. And so, you know, then the PLO retaliates. Now, there's a ceasefire already been put in place by the UN on all this that Israel just violated. June 5th, 2 days later, the UN passed a resolution to ceasefire by June 6th. Well, June 6th, Israel attacks anyways. Full force. Says, hey, we're going to carpet bomb the crap out of you. June 6th, again, UN passes demand that Israel cease fire. June 8th, U.S. vetoes resolution that demands Israel to withdraw. So why is the U.S. vetoing a peaceful revolution when Israel was the one to break the ceasefire in the first place? So that's always interesting to think that, you know, thanks there. June 15th, Israel still attacking, by the way.
What year is this again?
1982.
Okay.
June 26th, another UN resolution, U.S. forces used to ensure ceasefire, U.S. vetoes for reasons against the PLO. They don't like the PLO. They just like, we don't like you guys. So we're not really going to, you know, help you guys out or help out the country you're kind of occupying area in. But we're going to go ahead and send U.S. troops and a bunch of U.S. money to help make sure that Israel's okay. You know, we don't care about Lebanon. We don't care about Syria or the other countries involved in this or in the region, but we want to help out Israel because the PLO we think are terrorists.
What president was that in 1982, Greg?
Ronald Reagan.
Oh, okay.
The mofo himself.
Didn't we learn last time that we stopped? We started under the Reagan administration. We started supporting and not supporting nations based on our national interest versus moral causes. Yeah.
But we also, it started the precedent of ignoring chemical attacks.
Right.
So, I mean.
So, right around that
right
same
now,
time.
He would not strike.
Right.
Based on his force and policy.
We go to the next step. Right around the same time, hey, a new president elected. Mainly by Christians. Then less than a month later, he's assassinated with groups to ties to the CIA. Imagine that. Then we keep going, and through over those years, there's, like I said, there's Christians, there's Muslims, everything else. Well, like some of the Christian groups over there are really well known for massacring the crap out of everybody. Just some really vile people. And now, there's different kinds of Christians over there, and I've never heard of the name of the Christians, but, hold on, it doesn't matter, I'm not going to get into that aspect, and I understand there's a million different religions over there, but it's hilarious to see places like Breitbart and some of the other Fox News places, the Christians are getting attacked by Muslims. It's not the same thing.
Yeah, but that stuff is legit. I mean, the
two Catholic bishops getting beheaded last week.
The torching of the thousands-year-old churches in Egypt. I mean, I think a lot of times what Westerners do, the mistake that we make is we assign religion to political groups. And I think because this region is so tied to our religious faith, we think that because a group is assigned to one religious group, Christians or Muslims or Jewish or whatever, we assume that it's based on religion, when really it's based on F you, I hate you, you killed my brother, or
well, and all the
political control.
Most of the religious groups over there, are the political movements.
Right.
It's not Republicans, Democrats can be different faiths. No, over there, Christians are this political movement. Muslims of like the Sunni Muslims are this political. The Shiites are this political. And so that's kind of how it works over there. And there's subsets of that, and that's where you get the civil wars. And that's kind
of like
the thing.
It's like those damn Quakers are always Democrats.
Why do we got to mix politics and religion? It just never seems to work out. But continuing on.
Well, when your religion ends with a nation state of an Islamic nation state, that's pretty important reason to have it involved.
August 1983, Israel fully pulls out of central Lebanon. They're still in the south where they're not supposed to be, but that's cool. But in September 1984, things have been constantly deteriorating. The U.S. Navy fires on Syrian positions to protect the Lebanese army. So we've helped different groups in Lebanon fight and everything else. And so now we decide, hey, we're going to attack the crap out of Syria because they're still sticking around because their national security is directly threatened because they kind of border Lebanon.
They've been arguing, Israel and Syria have been arguing over the Golan Heights forever.
Yeah.
Well, and it's not even just about that, but they're like, this is a war-torn country. Some of these groups don't like us. So we're involved. They held the capital for quite a while, but the U.S. Navy decides to get involved where I don't know how Syria and Lebanon's issues between Israel is our own national security interest other than the fact that we funnel way too much money and military surplus into Israel, but I don't know why we had to get involved over there and bomb the crap out of them. So we've already, you know, had
really,
multiple actions.
You don't know why.
Them. Oh, I do.
You can't take a guess.
Oh, I can.
It's because they historically get treated so well by the rest of humanity.
Right.
What, Israel?
Yeah.
Well, a nation state that was imposed upon a region by a bunch of countries that had nothing to do with that region other than some of their populace having a religious aversion to Muslims being there. You're talking about a nation state like that that gets funded and has nukes and has special promises from all those big, powerful countries? You think that wouldn't be a reason why to hate them?
Why did we create them?
Why? It's political maneuvering, and it always has been.
But why did we create them? What happened that caused
Well, the Jews Israel? Were created kind of like the Kryons were. We needed a master, a slave race, to do all of our labor force. Am I talking about Battlestar Galactica?
Did you just go into David Icke there?
No. That's a completely different discussion. I got a little bit more to go, and then we're done.
Cylons, yeah.
Cylons.
What I say?
Cryons.
Crytons.
I also read a little bit about cryogenics
all right.
last night.
So,
but
long story short.
Hold on. And a little bit more. So through the late 80s and the 90s, it kept going. But a lot of the Lebanese Christian groups.
More. What? Way to let Maya have just a little more.
Yeah. Is that a lot of Lebanese Christian groups
you see the size of that
really
gun?
Started to come to power and really started to take stuff up. And they had, in Lebanon, they kind of had a split parliament, half Christian, half Muslim, which is kind of cool. You know, it's Lebanon. People don't think that happens over there. But, and it kept going where Syria was kept blowing them to shreds, just kept attacking them. And everyone was kind of like, thank God, these people are nuts. But what ended up coming out is that the U.S. needed some help in Iraq with Saddam Hussein during the first Gulf War. And what they did is they're like, well, hold on. The U.S. convinced Israel not to attack Syria for support against Saddam Hussein, who supported the Christian militias in Lebanon. So Saddam Hussein was helping a lot of the trouble in Lebanon. And remember, we initially set Saddam Hussein up into power when he funded most of his army.
Right,
gave
because
him
we needed
gas.
To fight Iran, so we gave him chemical weapons that he used on the Iranians and, the Kurds. That became our justification for toppling.
Saddam Hussein's funding some of these more fringe Christian militias in Lebanon who are destroying everything. Syria's destroying the crap out of them. Well, the U.S. says, hey, if you help us do this one thing, we'll tell Israel to stop killing you. And then it goes on. And so they do. And so all the way, and that was in the 90s. 2005, Syria finally withdraws from Lebanon. That was only, that's 8 years ago.
Right.
And we go through and it's, and you know what's really weird about all this is that the Christian forces Syria was fighting was backed by Israel. And these are the fringe guys. They're terrorists. They were basically terrorists. I mean, wow, Christian terrorists. Imagine that. No, they were. They were bombing stuff, car bombs, everything else. Israel was backing them. Syria is fighting them off. And the U.S. ends up telling them to stop firing each other so they can go and single-handedly attack Saddam Hussein. And it just – the whole thing's a mess. And right. I look back through all this information. I know a lot of this has holes in it and everything else, and I could have done a better job. But I look at this, and I'm like, if the U.S. would have never – ever gotten involved and would never funded and military provided military support to Israel, there would have been probably a couple hundred thousand less deaths over there. Maybe the governments would have been that free.
Do
but
we
you know want
to get into the Israeli
no
pro versus anti?
No.
I mean, isn't that sort of like the abortion argument? I mean, it's
I do not know enough about Israel
at this point.
All I know comes from
at this point
Bible
are,
school.
Now hold
back
on,
in the
real quick. There's a little bit more about Syria outside of Lebanon too.
Because I think you're being a little
pro-Syria.
I'm not being pro-Syria.
You're pro-terrorist.
No, I'm not. I'm saying I'm being pro-America, being goddamn America, what? Not being Israel and being, well, we've got this interest and somehow a bunch of fighting over in the Middle East, killing each other, somehow is a threat to us. So it's...
I have.
We have used, and I don't care how you feel about the stupid state of Israel. When you look at it, we have used them as a proxy to fight wars and control a region.
There is no doubt about that at all. And at this point, whether you think Israel should or should not have existed, they exist now. And it, as Greg said, I mean, I would like you to answer this question because I was thinking about you last week when he brought it up. If the United States withdrew protection, essentially. Now, we've used them as proxies to intervene in other countries, and that we can all agree is completely wrong. How would you answer the fact that, all right, if you stop supporting Israel or if you stop acting as their protectorate, essentially, saying that if you screw with them, we're going to screw with you back. If we stop that kind of support, don't you see wholesale slaughter of the people that live in Israel currently?
No. Right now, Israel has the military capability to wipe out half the people in the Middle East.
Right.
They're a very strong country. They have nuclear subs. They have a navy. They have nukes. They have all kinds of stuff. Now, the thing that I think is the problem here is that we've said, hey, Israel, you can have whatever you want. You can have weapons of mass destruction. You can have this massive military. You can do whatever you want. They're a very solid country. They can handle their own. And it's not really our problem to help them exist. Now, Israel in that area has been under a million different control from a million different kinds of people, hasn't it? Over the
Whole problem with the entire region is that, and this,
but hold on,
basically
sponsor-
for the last 200 years, the problem with the whole region is that it's tribal. It's very communal.
It wasn't always. Back in the 50s, when all these countries started getting their getting out from under the empires and the British were pulling out, they started doing really well and really advancing.
But those lines were drawn after World War One and
problem.
World War II.
None of them are nation states except for Israel.
No,
that's why there's no
but
stability.
You know what? It's going to take – how long did it take for America to really solidify itself as a country? Syria only did its independence in 1946. It took us how many hundreds of years to really solidify as a country?
And that was without the – I mean there was some interference early on with the British, but –
but that's the point. Is
but
that
by
these,
Lincoln, we started referring, you know, it's...
But when you get with...
Yeah,
with,
we got it with, together by Lincoln,
with Israel
right?
and Syria
no,
and all the
saying,
other the countries other, what
hold
we've
on,
done...
Hold on, let Greg finish here.
No, I'm saying, realistically, we had the Articles of Confederation after independence. That would be construed as loosely affiliating as a group of states. And then we have the Constitution, and that's what, roughly, give or take, 16 years later?
I don't know. We still had, like, the Wild West, though, and we had people going
we had
out.
Had territories.
Just, yeah.
Right.
Like, it was a lot of...
But the problem...
Those weren't states, though.
But the problem with all of that...
Part of America, a big chunk of America was just these roaming people.
The
like,
difference...
I,
yeah, the difference between that is, it, you know, the people who came to America came from a long history of established nation states. What we are seeing in the Middle East is a long history of hyper... I mean, these are very local communities. They don't think in terms of nation states. They have really no... The nation state exists in the Middle East. The nation state exists in the Middle East. They see it as oppression because, gee, whenever we get a nation state, we get some strongman backed by the United States or Russia or some other organization that uses us to oppress us. And so that's why you get things like the Arab Spring. My wiki trip today was about the lead up to World War One. The lead up to World War One was based on the control of the Balkans and the Grecian area, Northern Africa, the Caucasus. The Ottoman Empire in the mid to late 1800s was a dying empire. And so you had nations like the Russian Empire that saw that weakness and started annexing parts of the Balkans and the Caucasus. You had a war was launched in the 1870s.
Yep.
That, you know, they invaded the Ottoman Empire or Turkey.
Italy and Turkey.
The only reason that war was stopped is because the great powers of the day, the British Empire, sent a naval fleet to Constantinople to chase the Russian out. Well, what that did is there was the Congress of Berlin, and at the Congress of Berlin, they just started carving up the territories for the Western powers of the Balkan areas. And
France gets Algeria.
Right. And Italy feels that they didn't get their cut. And so France cuts a deal with Italy and says, well, you can have Libya, modern-day Libya. Well, a few years later, they invade the Ottoman Empire in Northern Africa, Tripoli, and Benghazi, modern-day Libya, and the Ottoman Empire gets their butt whooped by the Italians, which at that point, much like every other point in history except for the Roman Empire, people were like, wow, the Romans kicked their ass? That's pretty bad. And so what happens is the people of the Balkan Islands say, wow, if the Italians can beat the great Ottoman Empire, then we can finally stand up and liberate ourselves. We can finally take control of our own territories and stop having the great powers of the day interfere in our affairs and take control of our own destiny. And so that's when you get the First Balkan Wars, which lead to the Second Balkan Wars, which leads to the Great War of World War One, which leads to World War Two, which leads to, I mean, we had to go into Bosnia-Herzegovina in the 90s.
That's some of that stuff's really big, and that's the exact same that's happening today. And it's Israel's the proxy, because what happens, we say, Israel, have all this money, have all this free trade, but you know what? We don't like this one little group over in this other country, say Iran, or we don't like this politician over here, or he said something nasty to my wife when we were over there. So we're going to impose sanctions on these people. We're going to use Saudi Arabia and OPEC to restrict these people's production of their own national resource. And that's one of the things, is that that's why all these people fight, because they see Israel as our proxy over there.
But don't blame it on Israel at this point. Here's what I'm saying. Take it out of these specifics. Okay, what you had at the beginning...
Okay, they're attacking our proxy.
Exactly right. What the problem is, the mindset that the great powers of the day, back then it was the G8 of their day, which was France. Great Britain was the United States of that era. You had, to a lesser extent, the Russian Empire. You had the Austro-Hungarian Empire, the Germans. Now it's the G8. And the way that Russia and China and the United States, the way that they look at it is the world's resources ultimately belong to us. And what happens to the people that live in these nation states that the West created 100 years ago, how can we get to those resources? And the people of the Middle East ultimately at this point are saying, F you, leave us alone. Let us take control of our destiny. We know best. Gee, doesn't that sound pretty darn libertarian to us? And you have these incidences. We've talked about the Franz Ferdinand moment of the Tunisian fruit vendor who lights himself on fire in December of 2010, and it ignites the Arab Spring. And it's not because some guy lit himself on fire that the Arab Spring is ignited. It's the fact that we have been supporting corruption, The Russians have been supporting corruption. The OPEC nations have been supporting corruptions that directly, locally oppress people in these nations that have resources. And they're sick and tired of it. And that's why we have the problems that we have, because for every little intervention that we have in Syria, for every intervention that Britain or Russia had in the Ottoman Empire, it created another reaction. And so these little back and forths turn into big things. So the little excursions from the Russians into Turkey leads to the Italians invading Africa, which leads to World War I, which leads to World War II. It's all interconnected if you study history. It's not isolated incidents. Intervention in Syria means that there will be another intervention somewhere along the line, and it will escalate to a point that is catastrophic. 3.6% of the world's population, 62 million people, died in 4 years of the Great War, of World War I. 3.6% of the population, because of the madness of imperialistic mindsets and intervention. And if we think that Syria is just isolated and that the use of chemical weapons is some justification, it's not. It's the constant back and forth. That's why we shouldn't do it.
Well, that's the point I could make next, is that when we passed this bill against Syria for Lebanon, is that Syria was doing what was actually in their national interest, their national security interest, on helping control and stabilize Lebanon, so some of these groups like Hezbollah and some of the other giant Hamas militant groups didn't come and attack them, because they were against them. They were helping. They were basically helping themselves by controlling and just holding Lebanon in place.
Because, Greg, isn't it arrogant of us to sit here and say, well, we're just going to wrap them on the knuckles with a cruise missile? I mean, if Canada, when and if they do invade Indianapolis, hit us with a cruise missile, it's war. What happens if Mexico launches a Scud missile at San Antonio?
Has cruise missiles.
I think Canada has cruise missiles. Nah. They're just hidden. They're hidden under polar bears or something.
I totally get your argument on that, but it's impossible for that to be reality, because if we strike Syria, Syria knows
again.
That any strike back against us or Israel results in total invasion. If Canada strikes us, they know that we just roll over on top of them and take the maple syrup. Like, there's no threat. There's no real threat there. With the United States, we can dictate people's actions because of our strength.
But isn't that the problem? The problem is that we think that we should be dictating to how people live in a world away.
We do, but we also can't live in a world without economic resources and where we're threatened with constriction.
Okay. You read about OPEC. Everyone listening, read about OPEC. Read about how it controls how much a country's allowed to produce and who they're allowed to sell it to. We've been imposing sanctions and restrictions on how much you can pull out of the ground, how much you can refine, how much you can sell it for, and who you can sell it to.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that's fair? That's not economic anything. That's us imposing central planning on the rest of the world when we barely get any oil from over there. Most of all of our oil comes from South America, Mexico, and Canada. Almost all of our oil did. If we lost all overseas oil, we'd not even notice. Now,
oh, no. Yeah, you would, because anytime you limit supply, price skyrockets. So even though we don't directly buy from over there...
Well, you know, we're limiting supply right now. Did I not just say that?
No,
we're limiting how much they're allowed to produce and manufacture. Now, you add on top of that we've controlled all that. We're constantly in that. We are central planning out the market. We are allowing that to happen. That's creating strife. These people could live in a much better world and have a much better quality of life if we let them produce as much oil as they wanted and sell it to whoever in the hell they wanted.
That's
but instead,
the thing,
we control pipelines. We control where they can build the pipelines. We control who can have a pipeline. We control what companies are allowed to go over there. We impose U.S. companies and U.S.-backed companies onto these people.
But it's not just us. The Russians are doing it, too. The reasons that Russia is not involved in Syria because Russia feels that Assad is a great moral leader. They're there because there are two major natural gas lines that supply Europe with their natural gas, and it runs through Syria, and if Al-Qaeda is in charge of the nation, that's bad for their interests.
Wait, isn't Russia right over there, though, and they actually have their own pipelines over there? Why are we over there? there's enough oil in South America, Mexico. You know, we should invade Mexico next because there's so many natural resources there. If we help clean that country up instead of constantly funding their drug war, giving their drug war
lords.
They
need a good invasion.
We need to reinvade Mexico.
If we could maybe end the drug war and stop all that crap, we could get almost all the oil we need from Mexico and Canada and just be done with it. Now, we have no reason to be involved in the Middle East. It's been something that's been going on for thousands of years. It's because the old empire thing like you're talking about, there is zero reason to ever, ever care about what happens over there. There is no threat to our national security, nothing. If we weren't involved over there, there'd be no reason to attack us. No different than with Europe in World War II. There was no reason for us to get involved. We could have.
All right, that's an outrageous claim.
Yeah.
You're saying that. And even to the World War One, to a lesser extent, but you know, getting into World War One after years of isolationism, after 4 years of isolationism, we helped tip the scales. In World War Two, we maintain isolationism and non-interventionism, to be correct.
Yeah.
And by the way, if you see someone say interventionism on TV, like I saw Dana Bash do it on CNN, I tweeted the crap out of her. I was like, here's the correct term. Now, what FDR did is that FDR built up our resources and slowly prepared us for war and helped supply the British with resources leading up to World War II because he knew it was only a matter of time. And there came a certain point where there was a cable sent by Churchill to FDR saying they're about to destroy our entire navy. When the British Navy goes, which at that point had been the best navy in the entire world, said when the British Navy goes, it's all you. That's it. And we're probably, even if you get involved, not going to be able to win if you let them destroy our navy. You know, how do you argue that we shouldn't have gotten involved in World War II, given what Hitler was doing, the morality play, and also the strategy of it.
We can go back one step and say if we were never involved in World War I and didn't impose all that crap on that country and everything else we'd over there, World War II would have never happened. World War II is 100% preventable. But next step
should have, would have, could have.
Now, you go back with, we were funneling money and supplies and war machines to a country, England, that was previously known as the biggest empire builder ever, that had slaughtered and killed millions of people across the planet and has done some horrific acts against millions of different people all across the world, but yet we like them just a tad bit better than maybe Germany or Hitler, so that's okay. We'll right. support them. They're still evil dictators when it comes to many other countries, because only after the 2000s and late 90s did they really finally start pulling back all of their empire. So they'll note that, you know, 50, 60 years after.
But if you have to be colonialized, it's best to be by the British. They leave behind roads and school systems.
Well, no, but
then, you know,
who
by
would
the
build
people,
the roads? But,
then by the people who killed 12 million of the different.
Now, hold on. Then we get to Germany.
I mean, come on.
Germany would have never made it here. We're a country that needs to protect ourselves. Our direct allies to the north and to the south, Mexico and Canada, we would probably want to protect them because it would be in a strategic advantage. Over there, you know what? England, empire building. France, empire building. You read about what the French have done. Say, look at what the French did on the Ivory Coast.
My point is that
Why do we have to care what the hell happens to the evil, vile Europeans when they've constantly been killing each other for thousands of years? Why did we need to get involved? You know what? You know how we could have stopped Pearl Harbor from happening? If we would have told Standard Oil, don't sell lead to the Japanese and the Germans so they can fuel their tanks and their planes and their boats. We could have prevented Pearl Harbor, but we didn't. You know why? Because Standard Oil had great lobbyists and they had political connections, so they were actually specifically allowed to sell things to our enemies that they used against us.
All right.
There's a million reasons why we failed every step of the way in both those wars, and every war since, we have basically
But you
cost.
Come off, here's how you sound to people who don't think the way that you think. You sound completely heartless. You sound completely cold and callous. And that,
how many of our soldiers
hold
died?
Hold on. Let me finish my point, and then you may talk. Can I finish?
I suppose.
Can I finish?
I suppose.
You're not endearing people to your side by saying, let them eat cake, oh, queen, what's your face? I mean,
Marie Antoinette.
Yeah. Marie Antoinette. Now, what is your threshold? I mean, the entire continent of Europe, you know, every Jew on the continent of Europe is being destroyed. I mean, what is your threshold? I mean, is there a point where you say, okay,
hold on,
we can save the European continent, we can protect ourselves?
You know what I think about Europe?
What
I have no sympathies for Europe because I know what they've done.
At what point does your... Here's my question, okay? Let me frame it a different way. It's not about Europe. It's about national interest. At what point does your national interest button get tripped?
National interest button get tripped. That's an interesting question to ask an anarchist, but okay.
When they arrive on her door.
Right.
Well, no. There is always a valid reason to protect your national interests. As a country, yes, there is. I didn't see the fact that Europe, just because we had treaties and these alliances that we were constitutionally and by our founders' standards should have never have had, ever, any kind of contracts or treaties or agreements with other countries. They explicitly said that was the dumbest thing you could do, but let's not talk about the founders, but is my button gets pushed when people are directly taking action against the U.S., not France. Now, about us, we have supposedly allied with, like Israel, France, any of those countries. It's not one we ally with. Allies are cool. Hey, we think you guys are pretty cool, so we have a trade agreement. We can trade back and forth. That's awesome. If you guys start getting bombed, well, we're going to stop trade with you because we don't want to lose, you know, we're not going to force our companies to continue trading with you when they might lose their products. That's, again, central planning and controlled economics. So it's up to the business. If the businesses that wanted to, if people wanted to ship food and supplies over to Europe, they should have been able to. Fine, go ahead. Your boat's going to get sunk, but I don't care. You protect it yourself.
I mean,
we needed our boats on our shores. We needed our, you know, if we were
our
so
merchant,
awesome.
Our merchant ship, the Lusitania, got sunk in World War I, and that's what drew us into World War I. In World War II, we were attacked by the Japanese. The Germans had declared war
upon us,
but
with
they
the
had
Lusitania,
not yet attacked us.
It's a war going on. We're sending supplies over there in a war zone. Yeah, ship's going to get sunk. That's the name of the game with war. How the America thinks that we have the ability to go, well, there's a war. It makes sense not to maybe ship a ship over there completely unprotected. And we know that there's a valid reason that it might get sunk because it is a war that we're not directly involved in. But now we're going to use that excuse to go to war because we knew that might happen in the
okay.
first place.
All right, we're at about 60% Maya on this episode, so I want to get some Greg and Peppers in here. Respond to this. Respond. I mean, how do you, when you hear Maya talk about not intervening in some of these wars, what is your reaction? I mean, I find philosophical consistency in it.
Oh, so do I. Absolutely. As far as, though, Hitler goes, he marches, he takes England, he keeps expanding, he can ally, what's going to happen is Russia will ally with Germany, and it'll go down that route as well, instead of being our ally, to beat him back, because it becomes a lonely world. He just
become our allies because Germany screwed him, though?
Yeah, oh, absolutely.
Russia
but
Germany hated each other.
But when it's, that is the only competing ideology over there, National Socialism, that's pretty close to the Russian government already.
Russia and Stalin wanted Hitler to do what he was doing because they wanted to do the same thing. They wanted Hitler to clear the brush out of their way. And that's the thing with some of the Stalin's letters and some of the stuff that the government was doing over in Russia is that they actually wanted Hitler to take over and do things because then they would go back and then crush Hitler and take over all Europe. Now, that's
whether that was
that
possible is to be debated. But
Right. Regardless...
you have an ideology that was sweeping the world and was even taking foothold here. Never forget that there was essentially a plotted business coup against FDR. And that what it was is a group of businessmen, and they even had a general committed in order to have state socialism here. That was an ideology that was sweeping the world. People were the Hitler youth, the economy was devastated. They had no one to turn to. They were not a proud people. All of a sudden, here comes this strong man, charismatic leader that talks about German pride, that talks about the pride you should have. It is the same thing that Al-Qaeda preys upon right now, economic distress and pride. And
yeah,
those are a toxic mess.
They're recruiting. I mean, there was in defense of CNN, I watch a lot of CNN, and I'll tell you,
TV news.
Saturday, honestly, CNN was really good. Somebody, I think it was Anderson Cooper or Wolf Blizzard. No, it wasn't Wolf. He couldn't pull it off. But I think Anderson Cooper was interviewing like four or five foreign correspondents in Syria, and he said, you know, there was a kid that I used to sit and talk with all the time. We were friendly. He was a great kid. I ran into him the other day, and he's singing songs to Al-Qaeda, praising Osama bin Laden as his hero and honoring the 9/11 victims. I mean, he has totally flipped, and it's because of an economic circumstance. It's because of that. It gives them something to believe in. It gives them hope.
Yeah, oh yeah.
And boy, aren't we an easy thing to hate.
Oh, absolutely. We're the great Satan. We have intervened all over the world.
Right.
We have made our own messes in almost everywhere we've ever been.
It's a name rightly deserved.
The great Satan.
The great Satan. Because you think about the biblical teaching about Satan and how he influences the world, and he nudges things here, and he kind of twists things around here. It really, you think about it.
It's very screw tape letters. Yeah, C.S. Lewis.
We're very, very Satan-esque with how America operates. We're not always upfront about what we're doing, and we kind of lie and backdoor deals and do things in
we
a very
odd fashion.
We do backdoor
deals in order to get consistent flow of resources.
You know, do you honestly...
By the way, all hate mail can be sent to Maya, M-I-A-H, at creatingmaya.com.
I never checked that email, so
my last name is
Axton at... gmail.com.
My last name is Spangle, and I am a patriot.
317-938-2661. Give me a call.
Yeah.
She hasn't said anything.
Now, hold on. Do you honestly believe that the main reason, and it's a good reason, that we're involved in killing hundreds of thousands of people across this planet over the decades is for a consistent flow of natural resources?
What else
you
is
don't
there?
Believe that the resources would flow on their own and that we could help develop. We could have, instead of taking all of our money and taxes for this stupid military and this stupid military industrial complex, that maybe we could help develop Mexico. We could help develop the sand fields up in Canada.
On. Of course, well, of course we all believe that. Yeah. It's the people that are in charge that don't believe that.
And that's ultimately not the whole picture. Have you ever seen, I forget which Bond movie it was, it's the one where he blows up Fort Knox, and he talks about how
Goldfinger.
The way he doubled the value of his gold was by blowing up the existing supply. All you have to do is constrict supply. Doesn't matter if that's even the people you purchase from. As soon as you lower the amount available, the price skyrockets. Even though we don't buy from the Middle
East,
that's
what OPEC's called. All oil sales.
Let me finish.
If we get rid of OPEC, the enemies we have made now, and granted, we made our own mess, the enemies we have made, they will not sell to us because that is their way to get back at us, and then you have economic distress in the United States.
We have South America, Mexico, the Central America, and Canada. We would never, ever, ever
but they
have
are
to gonna
buy have
oil
a whole new
there.
Boatload of new clients.
But hold on. And you know what? That's the market. So you're saying we should use war, murder, and death.
That's not what he's saying at all. You're putting words in his mouth.
Okay. Sorry.
He is trying to explain basic economics that if you constrict supply, price goes up, you have economic distress.
He's explaining the way that the conventional wisdom. It's not what he thinks.
Okay.
Now, that is almost word for word what Osama bin Laden said about the United States.
Yes.
If you draw them into the Middle East, they will never... If you draw them in, they'll never get out.
Yep.
But if they stay, then you exhaust their resources by, you know...
Constant unrest.
And a no-fly zone would cost $1 billion a month in Syria. So I think we've wandered a long way into...
And go ahead. There's something more important here, too, because... Let's not say that if the United States never creates Israel, none of this ever happens. This area has been in constant fighting forever. I know you didn't say that, but I think that's common misconception, is that the U.S. has created all Middle East problems. These people, you want to really blame somebody? If Abraham's first wife had been able to have a kid and you don't have Ishmael, then we never have this problem.
Well, no, there is a lot of fighting over there. Now...
There has always not now, is it has been
on.
Constant.
It is a complete,
crappy place to live.
It's a culture of pride.
But
it's
hold
like
on.
It's just like
no.
The,
it's a culture of
you,
people
you
everywhere.
Look at, you, look at when the you look at when the empire started falling apart over there. The 1940s. You look at the creation of Israel. You look at the U.S. The U.S. hasn't been involved in these people's independence since it started. What I'm trying to say is that I believe that if the U.S. was never involved and had never supported any nation state over there. I don't care about Israel. I don't care about Jews. I just say, if the U.S. and these big empire builders have never, well, specifically U.S. because we've been the biggest lately in the past 100 years, is if we've never been involved over there, I guarantee you it would be 1/10 of the violence there is now.
Right.
We gave weapons to almost every country over there. We've given chemical weapons to almost half the countries over there.
We've supported their dictators.
But
yes,
but
people in the street.
Go back to the Assyrian Empire taking over Jerusalem, taking over modern-day Israel, the First Crusade, all of the Crusades. These are not things that we had any role in.
Right, no, but I'm talking about...
It's just the nature of human history.
But
it's not even these people.
There is no one to blame.
That's the area around Israel, right?
No, it is Israel.
Right,
it is Israel.
That's Israel and the direct surrounding area. I'm talking about the entirety of the Middle East we've turned
You told me what we should have done differently, Captain Hindsight.
Yeah.
I mean,
what do we do moving forward?
Right.
What do we do moving forward? Well, first off, we don't attack Syria.
Right.
My God. First off,
I don't
Russia
think anyone's going to disagree with that.
Russia would own us, first off, over there, because Russia's been itching for a very long time now to come back on the world stage and slap somebody around, and they want it to be us.
They're doing it to the gays right now.
Well,
true.
That's a distraction in their country. That's what it is. They like to always throw these big lobs out there and go, hey, what's causing some trouble with this group? Now, what's funny is this is actually a backward step for Russia and gays and the whole LGBT community, which is kind of weird. But Putin is the manliest man alive, and I would like to have his babies if I could have babies. But
one day, Maya.
Little icy-eyed babies.
Oh, God. They would be the most badass people ever.
Cold, but, heartless, murderous
you see,
babies.
Why not just get Daniel Craig babies? Because genetically, they look very similar.
They really
but
do.
Daniel Craig is the man.
No, Putin.
More than Putin.
Putin hunts bears. I'm sure Putin, like, rapes bears on a daily basis.
Does he ride a moose like Teddy Roosevelt?
He just does that.
You know what he does?
He has no
confidence.
He
takes that moose, he kills it, he feeds it to a bunch of bear cubs, and then he feeds the bear cubs to a killer whale, and he rides that.
Okay, all right.
But
let me...
what to do next?
All right.
You were trying to get there to what to do next before I talked about my love for Putin. But,
yeah, we know
Russia.
Tommy.
Is what do we do next? How all these things we're talking about the U.S. is involved in. If we stop being involved altogether, it would create chaos, maybe? Maybe not. Maybe the great peace. Maybe world peace would happen if the U.S. pulled out. No. What do we do next? What do we do about Syria? What about Syria's chemical gas uses and about everything over there? Nothing. Nothing. Honestly, think about it. Why should we? They have multiple factions fighting for power over there. We put Assad in place. You know how we could really take military action over there? We could send one guy. One operative over there with a sniper rifle and shoot Assad in the face. Problem solved.
Chuck Norris.
Yeah, well,
Chuck
that's what I'm saying. Is that all this
so
stuff, all
the
these things, why do we have to be constantly involved with that? Why don't we just cut it off? They're fighting for their own freedom. Everyone's fighting for their own freedom. Why don't we let them fight for their freedom on their own?
Right.
They're not fighting for their own freedom.
Well, I think
Maybe they want Sharia law. Let them have their Sharia law. Because here in America, we like Christian legislative morality. We allow ourselves to have that. Why didn't Russia come over and say, you can't have Christian legislative morality over here? We're going to bomb the crap out of you. We would technically should be okay with that, right?
Are you allowed to be gay and lesbian and trans in the United States?
Lesbian, gay, kind of, trans. It's a very scary world.
No, it is. No, I wouldn't. But... imagine
law
that
is not on my side.
Yeah.
Imagine that under Sharia
guess
law.
Guess what? Everybody's more terrified of you than you are
no,
of them.
No, but no, that's not a valid reason to pick
I think
up.
That's
is that
true
we're
for everyone.
We're technically in a better place than them, so we should bring them up to our point. No. If they want Sharia law, let them have their Sharia law. Why are we controlling who can have what government? Thailand's under a monarch right now. Should we allow them to stay under monarch? Because we historically know that monarchs are bad. Same thing with England. They're under a type of monarchy. So why don't we go over there and say, hey, you can't have this type of system. And France everywhere else, why don't we fight those people's oppressive governments? Why don't we make France pay for what they've done to Africa and other countries?
Okay.
You know, that's what I'm saying is that we let things play themselves out. We know for a fact through libertarian economics, if you falsely support something, it will never end up learning how to support itself.
Spindle's got his finger on the button here.
Yeah.
You teach a man how to fish.
We got to
need some music
I wasn't
to play.
Move on here.
Some get off the stage music.
No, no. Maya's been excellent this episode and has brought a lot of points that I think challenging points that people need to think about. If you guys disagree or have more to add, I mean, what do we do with Syria?
Oh, there's only... Or go ahead, Pepper. You don't have to talk at all.
Yeah, I just think if we let them do their own thing, they'll either figure it out or kill each other, and then we can move new people in there, try it again.
That's right.
Like, why? I totally agree. Why push around like this?
Pepper's for emperor.
Greg? I would be the laziest emperor ever, and you'd love me.
What's your name? Go.
Greg.
Greg,
thanks for having me on. I really have enjoyed this first episode. No. In reality, there's two decisions to make, really. There is, if you want stability, you support Assad. If you want to support people's right to rule, you have to abstain and let this take its course of events. Or you can do what we're kind of doing now in supporting the rebels. Ultimately, by supporting rebels and providing funding, you are creating your future enemies. Regardless, they're still going to hate us, even if they do win, even if they topple Assad. The most pragmatic approach is to make it appear that you support their right to rule, and then through backdoor channels, communicate to Russia that you support Assad, and not let that get out publicly if you want stability in the region.
Yeah, I think we so often completely fail to recognize that we're in the middle of history. And that's what I was working on today. That's why I got stuck in Wiki World, is because I was writing a column to that effect, that will be out, and look for it on WeLibertarians.com soon. You know, we fail to recognize that we're in the middle of history. And history has two groups of people. It has the people who are world shapers, the people who are the heroes or villains, and then there are the people who are just in the middle, not realizing that history is happening. And we have to realize the history of intervention, and that we just have to stop repeating that history, because the results are in. It's just like education, the government school way. It's just like economics, the Keynesian way. The interventionist foreign policy fails time and time again. So why would we keep doing it? It just makes zero sense whatsoever, and there's absolutely zero reason to understand or to support Syria. I don't even think Chuck Hagel supports intervention in Syria. I don't even think Barack Obama supports intervention in Syria. He just thinks that he has to maintain his mysterious political capital. It's so unconvincing the way that they talk about this. So hopefully we've given you some stuff to chew on. So go ahead.
What evidence do you point to that by not intervening, we get stability? Because
going to be stability either way.
While I agree, there is no... of course, in theory, as a libertarian, I believe that natural harmony is possible. I can't point to it. I don't know where it happened. I don't know. I don't think it even existed in the state of nature with original man. Otherwise, I don't think government ever forms. I don't, that goes into the philosophy I know you like, but the social contract. I agree to not shoot my neighbor, and we agree to certain contractual obligations so we can have more freedom and more security. But where on earth has it ever happened where no one intervened anywhere?
But you're arguing that if we, Rand Paul asked John Kerry this question, and he said, does it make it more or less likely that if we intervene, Israel will be attacked? And he basically, in traditional John Kerry fashion, said, well, both, just in a roundabout, long-winded way. I mean, it's chaos will continue in that region. It just means that the United States is the cause of their chaos, of their misery. Yeah. Instead of pointing their ire at 100% at Assad, 100% at bin Ali, 100% at Mubarak, 100% at the King of Jordan or elsewhere, 50% comes to us in Israel, 50% comes to the people that are directly oppressing them in their own nation state. Take that away. Let them fight for themselves and stop giving them an excuse. let them see the misery that, and we stop creating more misery. Does it mean that people are going to get killed? Yes.
Right,
but intervening means that people are going to get killed too.
And that's the thing is that when I talk about sanctions, is sanctions I feel are a bigger act of aggression than anything else, because when you say, "Hey, Iraq, I know you're trying to rebuild your country, but you're not allowed to sell oil to anybody. We don't like you. We're going to bomb whoever you sell oil to, or we're going to impose banking restrictions on them, or trade restrictions where they can't buy any product that contains more than 10%." Of U.S. manufactured parts can't be shipped to a certain country. Yes, we have that restriction on Syria right now. Is that we don't understand. We're killing people with those restrictions. We're absolutely 100% responsible. When we say, hey, you can't sell your natural resource, perish. Now, to talk to the point where you said you don't know if it's ever existed, if you don't know if it's ever really existed where no one's intervened. Well, the problem is resource scarcity, right? So you go over there. They have to develop things, and it's a struggle back and forth. That's fine over there. Here in America, and I'm going to really blame the government for a lot of stuff here and make it very broad and vague, is that if it wasn't for the United States government, we wouldn't have to worry about having as much oil as we have. Remember, Henry Ford made the first Model T to run off hemp seed oil.
Yep.
We could grow enough hemp in this country and not have to buy any oil for fuel. Now, imagine that. But the government has banned that. Then you think, power. Well, we have to have coal, we have to have oil, and there's resources, and there's fighting there, right? Well, no. We don't have to use coal. We could have had, possibly had fusion by now. Cold fusion by now. Hold on. I know you laugh.
I'm not laughing.
I'm saying it's possible. Look at Nikola Tesla and great minds like Nikola Tesla that because Tesla. Of grants and how the money from the government flows, we've held down some of the best minds in cold fusion. We've held down some of the best, most advanced minds through IP law and everything
Did
else.
Did you just admit that government funding can be used to advance things? That it has a purpose and a primary reason?
No. It is used to oppress things.
It kind of sounds like you just did.
No.
Government funding for scientific breakthroughs, maybe?
They've funded many, many things that could or could not have happened. Now, they've been funding the crap out of fusion, which hasn't fully happened yet, but that doesn't mean that's the right path.
You don't think
that
would exist anyway?
No, it could. It could exist on its own. But what I'm saying is the government picking its winners and losers has fundamentally reshaped how this country should have progressed. We should have been using hemp seed oil. We could have progressed onto something else. But because of restrictions, because of laws, because of patents, because of grants funding this side versus that side, is that we don't have to worry about resource scarcity in an advanced age. And if it wasn't for the government constantly restricting who could have what and who could do what, we would probably be a much more advanced nation. We would have we have third stage nuclear reactor plants we could build, which when you're done burning that fuel, it's almost inert. And it's perfectly effective. But we still have oil burning plants, which creates 10 times the amount of radiation in a 1 square mile radius in a nuclear power plant. And they're 10 times as dangerous. Then they make 100 times the waste. And like a coal power plant makes a whole bunch of nasty waste that we can't do anything with. So I just – all these things is that the region over in the Middle East, they're still developing. Just like Africa, still developing. I believe they should be doing a lot better if we wouldn't have been bombing the crap out of them.
Iran was a very well-developed
country. Yeah, I've seen pictures of like Iran before, like in the 70s.
Yeah, but that was under the guy we propped up. It was not like that at all.
It could have made it that way on its own. We can't say.
It was like that under the populist guy who wanted to nationalize all of Iran's resources. And so we toppled him and we put in some puppet. And then that's what led to the Ayatollah Khomeini. I mean, that's the direct history of him.
There's a theory I have.
If you go back even further,
we got to wrap up
the Middle East.
My one little theory about the whole thing is if you do not fight for your own freedom and you do not gain freedom under your own devices, you will never be able to keep it and it will never be real freedom. If someone else does it for you, you'll lose it. You'll give it away. Everything else. Same thing with this country is no one living today has ever fought for a single ounce of freedom they have. I'm a vet and I'm saying that. So if you want to say military people fought for our freedoms, that's another topic. Is that we've never fought for our freedoms. So it's not that big of a deal when we lose them. But imagine the founders and some of the people who fought during the Revolutionary War. They would have rather live free or die thing is a very true statement. Is that We are a country that have lost our freedoms and lost and willfully given up everything we've ever had for a little safety, a little security, and our lifestyle choices and so on and so forth. But these countries over there have never really had this freedom. They're still fighting. If they get it on their own, for at least two generations, they will not let it go. They will not. But if we keep dicking around with them, we keep propping things up and supporting this or that and telling them what's best for them, they'll never gain it on their own, and it will never be stable over there.
All right, final point, Greg.
Thank you for making your last point four or five times, Maya. Nah, never mind.
Maya.
I'm see that gun right there? There's seven hollow point rounds in that.
Aren't those illegal?
So shoot me.
Peppers,
hollow
ahead,
point
man.
Rounds are not illegal. Those are Hydra shocks. Those will I shoot I you in the gut, you're gonna bleed out.
All right. So we
I'm gonna let Peppers do final point and then I'm gonna do one.
Well, I don't know. I don't have much of a final point beyond, you know, let's just stay out of Syria. Let them solve their own problems. I think if you just let people to their own devices, they'll either die or they'll figure it out. But there's too many people for them to all just die failing.
Right.
You know, some of them will figure it out. And
right.
We'll have a good part of the world again.
And from my opinion, this is where I differ from most is, to me, a Sharia government is not freedom. So it is something they will, if they win, which they probably will not, all you get is Egypt last year ends up being overthrown, women and minorities, and they're oppressed. It's
well,
not a true
that's
win.
That's kind of, I don't know, I guess I didn't really make a final point, but I guess that just kind of seems a little short-sighted to me. Like, you're assuming first that that's the government they're going to instill, and then that they're never going to decide that's not the way to do things. Like, they're still learning.
In defense of Greg, the chances of there being a pro-freedom democratic
well, but
form
I'm
of government.
They need to make mistakes. They're at a point in their development where they need to make mistakes, and they need to make their own mistakes.
Religion is different than everything else. Religion
everyone,
has determined the course of our history.
Everyone has a god, even if it's not religion.
Males.
If it wasn't religion,
talk about oppression. Off. Fuck off. That
if
doesn't
there wasn't
mean,
religion in that country,
give me a
there
break.
Would be something else people are going nuts over.
National socialism.
That's such bullshit to
yeah,
sit
no,
there and say that you
there's
can't
stuff
have
like that in America,
hold on.
Too, just because technically
Captain Dildo over here. Just
you know why I said that, right?
Right?
He's talking about oppression. He's saying these poor people will become under oppression. You know what? You know what makes me happy and makes me proud of being trans is that I am fighting against depression every day. It's not that somebody else fought for me.
Yes,
it's that I'm fighting against my own, and so it's mine. It's mine to own, and it's my freedom to own.
I'm not going to sit there and belittle the struggles because I know what you have to go through on a daily basis. But saying that the three of us sit here and oppress people just because we exist in a certain
state. No, I'm not saying that.
Being.
I said it's funny that three
we
got
to check our
white
privilege.
Male.
Right, check your white privilege.
No,
the
but
door.
The funny thing. No, but that's that goes.
But you're
against,
only able to fight for it here. You would not be able to fight for it in Syria. You'd be dead.
You'd, yeah. Well, Maya probably would.
Live
be
free
dead.
Or die trying, and I probably wouldn't be dead. I'd kill many a thousand.
All right.
No, you'd get your shots in.
All right.
But you'd be
I've got to
killed.
Go to bed, so we have to read this final
yeah,
and get this
I
final
have to work
point
eventually too.
All right. So I want to read Pat Rue. Listener wrote in and asked a question, and we had
listeners.
Well, yeah, we have
not used to being on a podcast with listeners.
We have tens and tens of listeners.
Yes,
and
dozens, you might even say.
Pat Rue wrote in, and we had Dr. Ron Paul on the show earlier this evening, and he asks the following. So we will go in this order, starting with Chris Peffers, and then move around
the
L.
Twitter questions right away.
Yep, Twitter questions. That's how we treat our guests, like crap. I have one important question, however. With Dr. Paul out of Congress now and not likely to run for president again, what does this mean for the future of the Liberty Movement? I've talked to many other campus coordinators of Students for Liberty, many of whom say they've been introduced to the ideas of liberty through Ron Paul. I myself became a libertarian after reading up on Ron Paul and his ideas after the 2012 Republican primaries. I know we have people like Justin Amash, Thomas Massie, Ted Cruz. However, will they be able to get the same sort of national attention and outreach as Ron Paul? My fear is that the liberty movement still, and I prefer libertarian movement, people, please claim it, own it, still, in its very early stages, may stagnate and begin to lose the progress it has already achieved without a central figure leading the fight. Thanks a bunch, and once more, love the show. Sincerely, Pat Rue. No, hold on. We're going
real quick. Yeah. I actually sent him my response because you posted this, and then he gave me a response back to add a little context to exactly what he means. All right, because
we will start with Maya. Go ahead.
Okay, so I basically just kind of said I'm concerned about people like this believing that the Liberty Movement needs some certain central authority to be effective. We do not. We need a great deal of leaders and strong voices. Having a central point to focus on makes it easier to attack us and degrade us. They start calling us all racist at the Ron Paul letter crap, and just because our stuff may not be in the news nonstop doesn't mean we are not being effective. Look at the news and how no one really watches it. But if we continue to permeate into the culture, we end up getting shots out from popular shows. We empower other people to speak up locally. And I give some examples and things like that, and I talk about some of the other leaders we have. But he responded, thanks for the response. I actually think I agree with you, and I am so happy that all these people are out here doing great work. My only real concern with Ron Paul is that his campaign gave the movement a level of outreach that I at least feel in my young, naive age that the Liberty Movement probably didn't have before. I think I also might have phrased my question wrong. I think I overemphasized the importance of Ron Paul himself or any central leader when my real concern is keeping a consistent media presence and level of outreach. I guess I agree with you, though, that having a central leader allows the rest of us to be stereotyped when people shout racist or bigot.
Yeah, so I will go next. I think, you know, one of my concerns with Ron Paul, I love him. I was not a fan initially. I was politically homeless. I was fairly libertarian-leaning. But my hang-up was foreign policy. And it is Ron Paul who completely smashed all interventionist tendencies that I had in the 2008 debates. And part of my issue with Ron Paul in 08 and 12 was that it wasn't Ron Paul, it was the people that liked Ron Paul. It's that he was the only libertarian on the face of the planet. And I think there has been a level of idolatry with certain figures. I mean, when I got into the libertarian movement in the mid-2000s, there just wasn't that level of idolatry. They're just people, if you worshipped somebody, that person was swiftly kicked out. Now it's starting to happen. Like, if you post, like I post something about Ron Paul on the Advocate's Facebook page with 19,000 libertarians, and all the comments are how much Ron Paul sucks. Well, you know what? Stop it. Because most people know about libertarianism because they first heard the word because of Ron Paul or Rand Paul in the last 5 years. And that means that people will jump on the train and start heading down your way. But it doesn't mean that you have to bash them and say, oh, they're not real libertarians. They're not this or that. Stop trying to force people inside and outside of the libertarian box so much. People aren't libertarians. People hold certain levels of libertarian beliefs and values and principles. Like, some just have more than others. You know, stop trying to identify yourself as this is who I am. I am only this. You know, get some identity other than a political movement, for God's sake. I'm not bitter. Now,
None of us are.
Yeah.
Spoken like only a true political operative can speak.
Well-adjusted, happy people.
I think there's always going to be a level of sycophants who need a hero to worship. In any political movement, and libertarians have less tendencies toward that than anything else. But I don't find that that's a bad thing, because frankly, we need that. We need people who can sell tickets to a fundraiser. Sorry. We do. I think it's incumbent, Patrick, here's the sad truth. The biggest supporter of Barry Goldwater in 1964 was the head of the College Republicans, Karl Rove. And he slept in the basement of the RNC headquarters working for Barry Goldwater's election campaign like you wouldn't believe. He was a libertarian in the modern sense of the word. And unfortunately, he, like Ralph Reed, like Grover Norquist, like Jack Abramoff, if you watch the documentaries about Abramoff and that group, they all start out loving Barry Goldwater, and they are libertarians in their youth, and they float towards Karl Rove. And that's going to happen too. But there's going to be people like me who start off floating more towards Maya, you know, being a little bit of a softer, gentler face to what Maya believes.
You know, what's really neat about this show is, I think, for the listeners, look at what we've watched happen to Creighton Harrington. And there, Creighton's young, and I'm not going to talk crap about him, but there's this appeal of winning. There's an appeal of gaining more influence and growing into an organization like YAL and everything else that Creighton has. And you can watch over the past year that we've known Creighton and followed him and his talks that a lot of things have changed. With you, the same way. You've gone from one extreme, and you're floating very closely to another extreme. And it's really neat to see that you kind of are the
people
the
just
two
change
sides
and grow. Yeah, people change and grow. And it's not that Creighton is wrong, because Creighton is a pragmatist at this point, and he was not a political person when I first met him. He was a philosophical person. And then he realized that you've got to be involved in politics if you really want to make a difference. And if you're involved in politics, if you're going to change the American government, Maya, you're going to have to be involved in the American government. If you want to change the American government, you must be involved in the American government. If you want to change people's values and principles and make them see a different way, politics is probably the worst way that you can do that. And that is the shift that Creighton and I have both undergone. And I think you've undergone that a little bit, too.
Well, it's all necessary. It's absolutely all necessary.
Right.
You get the citizenry moral, and that'll trickle up to the government.
Right.
But that would be like saying, for the person that sent in the message, Martin Luther King would have been more effective if he was a representative in the House.
Right.
No way. I mean, he made way more change outside the system than he made in.
Definitely.
Didn't mean he didn't need people within the system who could also make change. It's about finding the role where you can be most effective. I know I reference this guy a lot, but William F. Buckley ran for mayor of New York City and Senate, lost both of them. But in all reality, he shaped modern conservatism of the 1980s, all the thought processes behind it. Ronald Reagan doesn't exist and rise as the face of the Republican Party, God, since 1980. To this day, you still hear politicians talk about that man with like reverence, even though when you go back and check the record, a little bit different. But in all reality, there has to be a concerted effort on three fronts. You have to have the political, you have to have the philosophy, the people who shape hearts and minds, and then at the same time, you have to have the iconoclasts who are essentially the first ones to the wall.
Who move the Overton window.
Yes.
They terrorize society until they see their point of view.
Well, we talked about that a little bit on one of my last episodes on the Incontrollable / Creighton Maya. We kind of did a joint episode, but the Overton window and shifting it. I just want to add one thing to both your spiels, is that not all of us believe that the government needs to exist, and so that's a third leg that we don't necessarily need. And so the third leg would kind of be split between the other two.
I know, but here's the problem with
I know, I'm just saying for the anarchists that are listening.
I know.
For the audience.
But here's the problem with you people.
Anarchism as a whole.
Right. No,
hold on. Here's the problem with you people.
Oh,
okay?
You people.
And
you
I don't
can say that
because
it's a choice.
I don't mean the trans people, because the trans people are fabulous.
Black.
It's because you're black. No, the problem that the philosophy of We Are Libertarians is that those three legs of any movement, the libertarian movement, all three of those are needed and necessary. And we want to do our best to present the points of views from all perspectives, because we find value in all of those perspectives. The thing that I have a really hard time with when it comes to libertarians is when you say that only your way is the best way. That if you are not an activist out marching in the streets, then you are not a real libertarian. If you aren't a think tank professional who only reads Mises, who only reads, you know, foreign policy, whatever, then you're not a real libertarian. If you don't do what I do, then you are not a real libertarian. You know what? That's an arrogance that you should just stop, because that does nothing but turn off not only other libertarians, but anybody who ever wants to think about being a libertarian. And the thing about Maya is that Maya doesn't feel that way. And Maya does a good job of coming on this program and challenging us to think in a different way, even if it is abrasive and it is tough and you do want her to leave the show early.
No, I don't disagree with Maya on anything. I just disagree whether...
Nothing? You don't disagree with Maya on anything?
Anything.
That is a bold claim, sir.
Let's talk after the show. I got a few things I disagree
with. No, I mean, for politically, for her positions, I absolutely believe like Maya does. Whether we can get there and it would happen seamlessly without mass hysteria and despair and murdering and a strong man rising. No, I don't know that that's going to work either, because I don't know if that ever happens.
As long as you, people like me, as long as you believe in the end goal and that that's a good end goal, most of us don't care, but I am going to shame people into doing more. I do believe that action on the streets and direct civil disobedience, I think, is one of the most powerful tools we have. Look at Martin Luther King. Look at Gandhi. Look at some of the greatest leaders throughout time. Civil disobedience has been their tool.
But you also
peaceful
had
civil disobedience.
Peaceful civil disobedience, too, but you also had the people who weren't peaceful. And Martin Luther King was wise enough to use those people to his advantage as well, by saying, you know, our march will be peaceful, but if you really hassle us, those people who are out on the fringes who are going to be standing on the edge of town, Sheriff, I don't think I can't control them. So, you know, you strike us.
You're not
going to
like my rabid dog that I don't have on
exactly.
leash.
I mean, I'm just a person that believes that I love politics. I love the game of it. I love policy. I want to move us towards a more libertarian. Do I think that we're going to see a voluntarist world in my lifetime? No. And so I don't want to sit on the sidelines outside of the game. I want to participate. And I'm not willing to participate in the Republican Party because I feel that's a fool's errand. So I participate in the Libertarian Party. It's just varying degrees, you know, and even Maya doesn't even vote, and Maya gets involved in the Libertarian Party, you know, and everybody has their varying degrees and everybody has their own thresholds, and, you know, none of it is bad or none of it is good. And I think it's just about finding pockets of leadership in every one of these areas and respecting other people and respecting their work. So we don't repeat the mistakes of the history of the libertarian movement. Read Brian Doherty's book, Radicals for Capitalism. And you know what? As much as we revere Murray Rothbard, the dude was one of the most divisive people in the history of the libertarian movement.
Oh, God.
Mises and Cato will never work together ever, ever, ever because of Murray Rothbard and Lou Rockwell.
You know what? Speaking of that, is that I've never read Rothbard. I've never read Hayek. I've never read any of these guys. The only true libertarian think I've ever read was Ayn Rand. I read Atlas Shrugged, and I have not read the last 15 pages because I refuse to finish books I like. I'm weird.
No kidding.
But I recommend to most people getting into politics, do not read these books. Do not read Rothbard. Do not read Hayek. Do not read any of these big names. Do not read Mises, any of them. Do not. Whatever you do, I think for a lot of people that you get so consumed in it and you buy into it so strong because in their book, in their context, in their world, it makes perfect sense. You know what the best way to really get into political philosophy and political ideology is? Get in some Facebook groups.
Yeah.
Go into a closed anarchist Facebook group and argue with those people. You want to have some of the most beautifully laid out arguments on the face of the planet? Do that.
Hey, I'll tell you what. Creighton, one of the reasons that I really have a lot of respect for Creighton is Creighton is one of the smartest people I know. He knows more about Austrian economics than I will ever learn. I personally find economics to be completely boring. I love foreign policy. I love domestic policy. I love politics.
We proved that when my dad was on the show, by the way.
I can't stand economics. It's stupid. No, you guys just are butthurt because I challenged you, and challenging two Hodgkins.
What's BRICS again? What's BRICS? You don't think it's important, do you?
No, I know exactly what BRICS is, and I knew it probably long before you did. So what Creighton has this foundation that he is taking to politics, and he also needs Amaya on a podcast to challenge him to make sure that he is still staying attached to those principles that he earned early on. So,
and in reality, you know, we're all fighting a war against statism,
right?
And the way you beat an enemy is by fighting, making them fight on multiple fronts,
right?
So that's what you do. And there is one thing that you can do, and if you don't do this, you're a crappy libertarian. That's
which is
not
listen to We Are Libertarians.
Exactly. If you don't do that, then you're not down
if you're not
for
going
it.
To WAL-radio.com and downloading every single one of the podcasts,
you're impure and you're out of the movement.
Right.
Or if you're not donating money to afbound905@yahoo.com on PayPal for my boob fund, then you really – could you imagine how much more powerful I'd be with a nice set of tits? Think about it. Think about when I go over to Thailand for a couple months to get my face redone and my tits.
You'd be the most powerful woman in this room. So to answer your question, I think that the libertarian movement is growing in spite of Dr. Paul's exit from the broader stage. I think if you have libertarian or libertarianism set as a Google alert, as Greg and I do, it's exploding all the time. The word is everywhere. So, you know, I think the movement's growing. The movement is growing, and it's just a little more complex, and it's not going to be as mom and pop, unfortunately, in some ways, but also fortunately in others. So try and find the value in everything instead of just saying that there is no value because it's not done my way. That will make me tolerate you more.
And keep in mind, if you're that person that bashes Ron Paul, you're also that person that bashed Martin Luther King Jr. for maybe running drugs behind to finance his organization and different affairs that he was going to get blackmailed with. You're that guy. If you want to be that guy, that's fine. But remember, no one remembers that guy.
And no one is spotless and perfect.
Yes, I mean, they build monuments to Dr. King. They do not build monuments to the nerd that sits in the back room and says, yeah, but he was having an affair. And,
right.
You know,
they
don't be
build
that person.
Monuments
he did
to
have a lot of disgusting affairs.
There. Yeah. They build monuments to people who start podcasts. That's who they start monuments for. They never finish the monuments, but they start them. All right, final thoughts. Let's wrap up this episode. I thought this episode went fairly well, especially since I've had 4 hours of sleep and I didn't want any of you to come over. So, Chris, what we do at the end of the show is we give everybody an opportunity to say a final thing, something you want to promote, something that you failed to get in during the rest of the show. Anything that you would like to say here at the end to inform the listeners, Chris Peffers, and put that mic up to your face for me, son.
Yes, sorry. I'm just trying to play it cool.
I know.
I don't know. I don't have a lot of final thoughts right now. You're putting me on the spot.
All right.
Go Liberty. And, oh, I didn't get to answer the question. Ron Paul is like Peyton Manning. It's great to have him, but when he leaves, he causes everyone to step up their game.
That's right.
And that's what's happening right now. Everyone's trying to be the new Ron Paul.
That's right. And
true. No one's going to be the new Ron Paul, but we're going to have a bunch of them sharing the load, I think.
Nature abhors a vacuum.
That's right. Yep. A strong man will rise.
Always.
Greg Lenz.
I actually am starting to come around to the idea that we are not going to attack Syria, and that we are posturing so we have cover. It's a little bit of CYA, and we're gonna support Assad.
Right.
I think we are.
Okay. That's a bold prediction.
I do.
All right. Maya freaking Axton. That is your middle name. I've given it to you.
Really? Because I'm still going to change my name legally to Maya Axton, but it's going to have other stuff in
it. Are you sure that you are able in this time to find something that you can promote? Are you comfortable self-promoting? I'm not sure.
I can self-promote. TheUncontrollables.com, CreativeMaya.com. Go there. Be there. Do it. Used a hashtag.
Call into the show Tuesday.
The full word, the F word, the full word. Cis people use also. Actually, Google Magneto was right. It's an interesting thought process there that my loudness and my abrasiveness is effective.
You don't need to Google anything. All you need to do is go listen to the last episode of Creating Maya at creatingmaya.com.
Yes, do that.
And we will explain it.
Yeah.
All right. Final thoughts from me.
Hold on. Whoa. I wasn't done yet.
Oh, okay. Call into her hotline.
Call into her hotline.
Yeah, my show is going to be live in the future. Huh. I actually,
she has more to say.
As far as I know, Monday is my first day starting to work for Papa Roo.
No relation to Pat.
This is Papa Roo, Art Bouvier, the awesome local person around here that was international fame for a while. I was actually on Glenn Beck's show. I'm going to be working for him, but every Tuesday I'm going to be having my show. Remember, it's The Uncontrollables on IndianaTalks.com at 3 p.m. If you don't call on my show, I'm going to hate you. But if you call in and you screw around and you act like Batman, I'm
going
to drive up to your house. I'm going to burn it down.
That was pretty funny when he did that, though. Okay, my final thought is I am going to start contributing to Halley Politics Indiana. He's asked me to join as a columnist to give the libertarian perspective at HalleyPolitics.com. So check that out. It's sort of like the Indiana Politico. So it's kind of a cool opportunity for me. I'm very excited about it. and I will be posting my first column hopefully here soon. So,
in other news, he is moving on from We Are Libertarians for better opportunities.
I've forsaken you guys for a website that has readership. No, if you would like to contribute to We Are Libertarians, we're constantly trying to make the product better, trying to expand it, and we do it for free because we love you. So if you'd like to contribute for free, then hit us up. Hit up Joe Ruiz at Ruiz, R-U-I-Z, at WeAreLibertarians.com. If you would like to help fund some promotion, listen, we love doing this.
You'll take their money?
We're not going to spend the money on ourselves. We're going to buy Facebook ads to grow the and Google ads and all that good stuff. So if you want to contribute to that to spread the word a little bit, go to WeAreLibertarians.com to the PayPal section and send us some money. So, or find me and give me several million dollars of cash, Walt. That's a Walter White joke. All right, well, thank you for listening to this episode of We Are Libertarians. Even though it was a solid 8.5 on a scale of 10, next week we promise
to do better next time.
Music for We Are Libertarians is provided by Hoosier musician Brian Keith Wallen. Please check out his website, briankeithwallen.com. The song is Bad Spell.